Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with our crew today, and we're going to be talking about a variety of different things. First off, though, we have to get Sam Bradley here on the show, and Sam, as always, it's a pleasure to join you once again in the podcasting cockpit.
Have we ever counted how many of these we've done, Jamie, in 8 years?
You know, it has been a lot. I'll have to go back and take a look. I can look at the server numbers and see what that has.
It might be a real interesting factoid. Well, we're a little bit short tonight. We got Dr. Joe with us, of course, and our meteorologists are all busy either working or going to birthday parties. But Becky was good enough to send us a little crystal ball update, which has some interesting factoids in it. It made landfall on Sunday evening along the coast of southeast Louisiana with max sustained winds of 5 miles an hour. I kind of wonder if that's what she meant. And a minimum central pressure of 922 megabars. Here's the good part. Since the National Hurricane Center named storms, since they started naming storms in 1950, they never had a sea named storm or the third named storm of the Atlantic hurricane season that arrived as early in the year than Cristobal. So that's a first. With its classification as a tropical storm on June 2nd, it arrived 3 days quicker than the system that previously held the record, and that was in 2016. So Madison, Wisconsin recorded an all-time low pressure observation for June when Cristobal caused readings to fall below 29.21 inches of mercury for you techies out there. For those of this that aren't, there was about 12 inches plus of rainfall across Florida, producing rain, high winds, flash flooding from the Gulf Coast all the way to the Great Lakes. And subsequently, I've seen that bunches and bunches of people lost electricity. Anything else you've heard on it, Jamie? This was actually sent to me the day before yesterday, so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's come through. I asked Joe earlier before we started recording about the, how things went down in Memphis, and they had a bunch of rain. We had thunderstorms and things roll through last night as the time we're recording this. So, you know, it's made its rounds across the country, like those storms that come up through the Gulf generally do. They tend to come out through the Northeast, and this one did as well. So, it's early in the season, and we've already had three storms. I wonder what's next. It's kind of the way I'm looking at it.
Yeah, that's kind of a scary forecast right there. How are things down there in Memphis, Dr. Joe?
Well, we're doing okay. We got about 3 inches of rain from Cristobal as it passed by Memphis on its way north. So that made for a very rainy day or so. But since then, the weather's been super nice and really pretty.
Good. I still don't like your humidity down there, but that's okay.
It's coming back.
Yeah, I'll bet it is. Our guest tonight is somebody I've known for a really long time that I connected with in 2006 when I started working for the state of California, with my function being to create a state-level disaster assistance team, kind of modeled after the DMAT. So I looked around the country to other state teams that seemed to have it together, and in doing so, I found Timothy Connolly, and we've been friends ever since. And like I told you, Joe, this guy's resume is at least as long as yours. So I'm going to stop with, fire guy, fire medic, and disaster worker, and he can go into more detail on that. But first, anything on the COVID front?
Yeah, things have kind of settled into a little less, frenetic pace. I think what's a little bit concerning about what we're seeing now is that, everybody around the country seems to be at a bit of a different state of reopening. And in some of those places, we're seeing numbers increasing, and in others, we're not seeing much of anything. That's been somewhat head-scratching, I think, to especially the modeling people who, are attempting to figure out what this thing's going to do next and where it's going to go. And I think the part that is at least to me, sort of most concerning is that while this pattern has not been is not typical of past influenza outbreaks and things like that, in general, the only other major pandemic that's looked much like this at this stage is the big flu pandemic of 1918. And the concerning piece of that is that that flu was, you know, pretty bad for a few weeks and then got very quiet with sort of scattered outbreaks here and there. And then about 4 months later, came back with a vengeance and killed a lot of people in a very short time. So, you know, I think as I look forward, what I worry about is that we're going to have a very busy fall. We are locally already seeing emergency department and EMS numbers back to pre-COVID busyness levels. And our COVID numbers here and in this region continue to climb slowly but steadily. So by the time we hit the fall, we're going to have a lot of really sick patients. And so my warning to folks would be don't let down your guard on PPE. Don't stop continuing to stock up on PPE because you're going to need a lot of it in a few months. And be prepared for the marathon, not the sprint.
I'm sure Tim's thrilled to hear that. But before we go to Tim and all the things he does, Tim, you had a patient presentation that you wanted to run by Dr. Joe that could be COVID-related.
Yeah, so we had a cardiac arrest patient. Got there, a patient was in VTAC. You know, started medical care, shocked the patient once. They went into kind of a PEA. When we intubated him, it was extremely hard, even bagging without the tube, it was extremely hard to bag the patient. A lot of resistance. We got rasp back, saw a shark tooth on capnography. The patient would arrest again. Ended up giving an inline albuterol, which seemed to help. And eventually the patient did sustain rasp. But we weren't sure what the patient's history was at the time. We don't believe they had any respiratory conditions ahead of time. So I was feeling that could be maybe a presentation of COVID, but wanted to see what you thought.
Well, hard to say. You know, I mean, certainly it sounds like that patient had some sort of pretty restrictive lung process going on. And late in its presentation, COVID certainly has a ARDS-looking picture that can lead to very poor compliance in the lungs and therefore patients that are very hard to bag. It is also not uncommon to see patients who look okay and, you know, don't appear to be terribly sick to deteriorate very quickly and subsequently, you know, die. So, you know, those features are certainly consistent with what could be a COVID presentation. Hoping that somebody's testing that patient as they try to figure out the reason for that arrest in the first place. But it'll be interesting to know if she tests positive or negative.
Yeah, well, I think they're waiting for the results to come back on that now.
Tim, are they good at getting back to you guys if there is any kind of contagious disease issue? I know most systems have that in place. I'm sure COVID would fill in there as well.
Yeah, under the state health rules, they have a certain amount of time they have to notify us by, and they seem to be doing a pretty good job of it.
Okay, good, because that would be very good to know. Well, Tim, why don't you give us a real quick overview? Well, I'll start this by saying when Tim and I met, we talked about state teams, and at the time there weren't a whole lot of them. His Illinois team and Missouri teams were pretty well set up, probably better than any in the rest of the country. So in discussing this, sometime later we had one of our, when we used to have training through the feds, we had one of our training summits and got to talking to Dr. Brian Frelke, which Jamie and Joe know. And we ended up creating this nonprofit disaster organization focused on resources four states, which we call the inner IDMC. And that's only one of the things that Tim does. So, Tim, take us into motors and your DMAT experience and IDMC, and then we can kind of relate that to Joplin, because that was one of the big ones that you guys went on, because I was kind of there in spirit with you.
Yeah. Well, like most people in EMS, I'm not happy just wearing one hat. So I do a couple things. Sam said I do the IDMC, which Sam failed to mention. She's one of the founding members of, and she's provided a lot of support over the years for IDMC. So thank you for all your hard work with that, Sam. I do IDMC, and I'm also a planning officer for the state level DMAT team in Missouri. And then I work for a company called RSI, who partners with Louisiana to staff field hospitals during hurricanes, and or I should say medical shelters in Louisiana during hurricanes. So I do get my fair share of disaster stuff. And then I work on a Glenside Fire Department where for paramedic services, I'm the emergency operations coordinator. So my day's full, but it's all very much worth it.
Well, you certainly make a contribution too. The one thing I'm interested in is there's a lot of interaction between Illinois and Missouri, which is, of course, one of the things that IDMC promotes is, you know, looking at ways to share resources and so forth. You want to talk a bit about how that works? It's apparently been in place for quite a long time.
Yeah, since I used to, in my former life, I was actually the team commander for the Illinois team before I became the plans officer for the Missouri team. And that's how kind of IDMC connected those two together. But the whole goal of IDMC is so states don't have to reinvent the wheel. When Sam was working with California to stand up her team, we handed all our policies, all our procedures and stuff to Sam. But we also came out and watched, I think it was called the Rough and Ready Exercise in California, where we went back and we learned things and we shared those lessons with Missouri and Illinois. And so over the years, the partnership with Missouri and Illinois has worked out real well, to the point where if something happens in Illinois, the Missouri planning team would actually plan the response in case we had to go to it. Or we cross-share information, and if there's something in a southern part of Illinois or happening, you know, we share that information in Missouri. And the whole idea, not just those two, but all the states, is share best practices. So we're all operating on the same page, and God forbid there's the major earthquake happens in the Missouri-Illinois area, the New Madrid Fault. We all kind of get an idea what our playbook's going to be ahead of time.
Yes, and that specter is always there. You never know when that Midwest quake is going to happen. The rough and ready exercise he refers to was in 2006 when Governor Schwarzenegger bought all of these, or commissioned us to create all of these disaster assets, including the CalMAT, which I was working on, all the mobile field hospitals, just, you know, the ambulance strike team concept, all of those. And I'm glad Tim could come out and see all of that, because it was a pretty good model. But yeah, the other thing too, Tim, is IDMC provides a website with different resources that can be used during a disaster, correct?
Yeah, so we provide a lot of IT format. We partner really with Microsoft to create a lot of it. It's actually an interesting story with the Joplin tornado Microsoft. A couple months before the Joplin tornado, Microsoft came to us and said, hey, we got this disaster software to kind of take a look at to use for community collaboration. Well, we looked at the software and we said, well, we can use this for state disaster plans and state team communication too. So we had the national exercise, the exact name of it is escaping me right now, but the national level exercise happened to the day before Joplin tornado. So Microsoft came out, we used this software for the entire exercise. And it was a 4 or 5 day exercise, about 16 hour a day work, with multiple players, multiple site locations. So we used this software to coordinate the exercise, to help coordinate the exercise, I should say. So the exercise ended, everyone went home. The next day that the Joplin tornado struck, we called Microsoft and said, hey, you know that software you just turned off? Turned it back on. We're going to use it for real. and Microsoft actually put a player on the ground to help us use it during the Joplin tornado. So from then, we've kind of partnered with Microsoft in many aspects, and they've given us many IT formats for communications, collaboration, and those kind of things that we can share with partner agencies.
Right. We're working on some projects with AT&T right now as well, and some other things.
We've been working on a 3D printable ventilator right now.
That was what I was going to ask you about, because I told Joe about those. Is that something we can talk about, or is it still in the works?
It's still in the planning phases. The basic concept is a bunch of engineers and a couple of respiratory docs got together and reverse engineered a old World War II vent and made it 3D printable. So we're working through all the legal hoops right now, you know, the FDA and all those kind of things, legal protections for the people using it, printing it, et cetera. But our hope is we can get it up and running for the fall. I mean, it's not going to replace an ED vent, but in a disaster situation, in a tent, in a field hospital, even though we try not to use the word field hospital, so we'll say alternate care site. How's that? In an alternate care site, you know, when there's nothing else available, this might be a good tool. And yeah. Dr. Froehlke is heading that up for us, and he's doing a great job with it.
Oh, he's awesome. He does everything, this guy. And he's our medical director. So, Joe, you have one coming to you when that gets all approved.
I'm absolutely looking forward to it. I can't wait.
Anything else, Joe, that you're thinking about that we've talked about so far?
Well, I'm always fascinated by the technology piece of that. You know, I think the sort of formalized major disaster response entities, particularly government-based, tend to be a little slow on the technology uptake. And it's nice to see technology experts like Microsoft who, you know, will dedicate people to show you how to take advantage of the tools that they develop, because I think folks in the governmental administrative world generally just don't have an opportunity to be exposed to that very often and don't think in the kind of ways that allow them to use a particular piece of software or equipment or something in a novel new way that we hadn't thought of before.
Exactly. And this is one of those things where we can help work with companies to create these assets, and some of these states that aren't well developed yet can take advantage of them as they create their teams and respond to different disasters. So, Tim, talk a bit. Well, I'm going to go to Jamie here first to see if he had any questions, but then I want you to talk a bit about the Joplin response. Jamie?
I don't have any questions, but I do have, you know, just a, you know, comments to follow up on what Joe said, and that was that, you know, that we've talked a lot here on the Disaster Podcast in the past about how technology can influence disaster response positively and negatively. We've talked about social media. We've talked about using specific apps that could be used to help with volunteer responder dispatch. It's great to hear how technology companies are out there looking at how to integrate their available services with response units and response organizations. And I'm always excited to hear about that.
Yeah. Well, Tim, I remember the day you guys responded, because I sat there in California going, okay, I'm right here. Tell me what you need. And that was our first real jump into what we do. In fact, you were the one that coined it, the mom and pop taking care of each other thing. Because since I was across the country, we decided that whoever wasn't doing the disaster would be there to support those who were. And that was me. And so I was... you know, things have changed a bit since then, but I was the one looking for certain kinds of equipment that you needed and passing that information on and so forth. But what was that day like?
Yeah, so I'm sure everybody's familiar with what happened with the tornado itself and struck the emergency hospital pretty hard. Before I get into what we did, I just want to say that, you know, the real heroes of that thing were the employees at Mercy Hospital. They self-evacuated using any means they could. They did a great job of patient care. You know, they were hit hard. The building was damaged beyond repair. The infrastructure was damaged beyond repair, and they still managed to do an amazing job. So that never comes up in conversations. They talk about that, you know, the state response and these kind of things, but the people who, the nurses, the docs, the staff at the hospital, I mean, they did an amazing job of evacuating that hospital with what they could in the best time they could. So, I mean, they deserve credit for that. With the Missouri disaster, state-level disaster medical team, at the time it was a 501c3. Now it is it's actually all everybody's state employee now. Deployed a couple of rapid response trailers, which are like six-bed, I don't want to call them full ERs, but similar to an ER, trailers to support the emergency operations in the beginning. To handle a little bit of the surge. There was an alternate care site set up prior to our arrival, which was only a few hours after the event. And those guys did a great job, you know, basically replacing the emergency room for part of the city until they could get, you know, there's another hospital very close who did an amazing job also, but to kind of take some of the pressure off them. And so those guys worked for a couple of days. Then after several days, we deployed a mobile medical facility, which is more of a hospital type environment, but not actually a hospital. It does have, you know, medical air pipe through it, x-ray, ultrasound, the pharmacy, those kind of stuff. And we set that up with the support of National Guard. The guys set it up in record time, did an amazing job. And then the hospital network actually took that tent over, system over through arrangement through the state and the 501c3 at the time. And this is where Sam came in. We augmented it with a trailer to give them CT and to do surgeries and those kind of things. And so it actually worked as a hospital then for several months until they could come into a permanent structure. So to my knowledge, it was the first time that one of those hospitals has been set up like that. And so it was a truly amazing response because it wasn't one organization. You know, the state medical team did a great job. The local people did a great job. They were very resilient. You know, the hospitals around the area certainly stepped up, you know, sharing equipment, supplies, personnel. Sam did a great job, how, you know, to turn it into a real field hospital or field medical center. I keep saying hospital, and I know I shouldn't say that because it really isn't a hospital. But to turn it into a field medical station, Sam did a, you know, a great job on the phone trying to help us find a way to get, is, you know, one of the things, I don't know if they remember, hey, see if you can find me a trailer we can do surgery in. You know, those kind of things.
And a portable x-ray machine. They didn't have too many of those back then. I remember that one. Well, it was good to be a part of it and support you guys, even though, you know, I was far away in California. You know, it's an interesting perspective to see how the state team folds into and what comes after. That's where the beauty is, because as we know, Joe, the USAR FEMA assets and the DMAT HHS assets are going to be at least 72 hours. And when you have a hospital destroyed like that, they need medical people out there. And in that interim, you have the state team that was willing and able to, you know, fill the gap, if you will. Did federal resources eventually go out there?
So there's a federal DMAT team deployed, and then the REC was deployed, Captain Hall, which was a huge benefit. We did kind of, and that one, when I say we, I don't mean me or my team. I mean everybody kind of let the DMOR team down a little bit on that one. So the public had an impression that they could just show up at the DMOR trailer and just collect their remains of their relatives, take them off and do whatever. They didn't realize it was a process and identifications and all those things. And as an organization, everyone involved, we did not really communicate that well with the public. So we didn't communicate realistic expectations on how that process would work. And I'm not an expert in the DMOR process by any stretch of the imagination. But we had experts there who could have given us any information to communicate. I mean, I did several interviews with CNN and that myself, and I didn't mention DMOR. And so that was a mistake that I made, is that I should have, again, everyone should have got in front of that and kind of explained that process to the public, because there was a lot of fatalities associated with that event. So the federal DMOR team was there, and then the REC, Captain Hall, was there. She did an amazing job. We needed regulations waived. We needed advice from the feds. There was a lot of things. And the federal government response from HHS and U.S. Public Health Service, I think, did an amazing job.
Yes. It's kind of weird to be working. I was running the state team during the 2007 fires in San Diego, and then the DMATers came in, and they were a bunch of people I knew, and it just felt kind of weird being on in a different uniform at the time. Joe, you can speak to some of this, I'm sure.
Well, absolutely. I remember Joplin well, you know, and wasn't that long later that we were in Oklahoma, Moore, Oklahoma, with a very similar picture where the hospital there got hit and, you know, massive damage to a very small community. So same kind of thing. You know, the local folks were there quickly, organized very quickly. And it's just amazing how much faster the sort of outside big resources, i.e. the state, the region, the feds and all that sort of stuff. You know, when you show up and things are kind of already in place and already rolling, it just changes the entire sense of the disaster in that you feel automatically and much more quickly like you are productive and contributing. You know, there's a mission and the mission is clear and you can jump right in and actually feel like you can do a lot more good, as opposed to having to try to build a lot of infrastructure and figure out what needs to be done and all that.
It's amazing when you had the locals working so well and then the state and the federal teams come in, it's amazing how quickly you see the uniforms disappear figuratively, you know, and everybody just becomes one team with one fight.
Absolutely.
And thank God it's working that way, because it took a while. This didn't happen overnight. It took quite a long time. In fact, I remember the 2000 fires in San Diego and having to, of course, they didn't know what a CalMat was. It was brand new. It was our first appointment in creating those relationships with Red Cross and some of those other agencies. Jamie, any thoughts from you?
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, something that Joe's talked about in the past on his deployments. And one of the things that he's always thought of is an important resource is the, you know, the virtual Rolodex that you build up over time to have those resources and thoughts and ideas, like for things like, you know, I need a trailer that you can do surgery in. You know, once you know how to do that, once you've done that once, you now have that in your bag of tricks. If you need to do it again, you know where to get one. And Joe, you've talked about that in the past, I know.
As with many things like this, it's often a little bit about, you know, just sort of knowing the networks and knowing who to get in touch with, who knows the person that knows how to get that done. And as you, you know, as you get more experience in those operations, you, of course, begin to come across similar people or at least folks that are in similar roles to what you've been exposed to before. And so you begin to know not necessarily who to reach out to, but what position to reach out to help get those kind of things taken care of.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because when Hurricane Sandy hit, I remember getting deployed on Facebook. What? That can't happen. Seriously. Well, the guy in charge of operations was someone I had done many, many exercises with in rolling out their electronic patient care record. And so he was quite familiar with me, and he wanted me. He couldn't get me on email. He says, I knew I'd find you over here. Hey, do you want to come to New York? And I said, sure. He says, give me your commander's phone number. That was kind of weird. But when they want you, they will find you. So that's an interesting.
Jim? It's funny, Sam, it's funny you say that about Facebook. It's a story where Facebook worked against me. Just because my daughter's in the Navy, so I'm shooting this one out to her. When one of the hurricanes, I can't remember, to be honest, which hurricane it was. I was going to Louisiana. I want to say it was Isaac. I'm put on Facebook that I was being deployed, and I had not told my daughter ahead of time, and she saw it on Facebook. That did not go very well.
Yeah, you got to be careful about that. I've had my brother sitting in the other room. Like the other day, he told me his truck was broken into. I ran out there and go, what? I saw it on Facebook. There you go. So, Tim, in respect to all of the different jobs that you do that are all important in disaster, including your fire agency, your work with the state, with all the different teams. How do you balance that? How do you decide which one has priority?
It's not easy. Fortunately for me, until COVID, the jobs were kind of spread out, which is kind of how I picked them. You know, the reason that they brought me onto the Missouri team is because if there was a major earthquake in Missouri, my family wouldn't be affected because they're all in the Chicago area. So I would be able to do that dispassionately. You know, Louisiana is very separated from Missouri. So the chances of me being needed at the same time in both were very small. Now, with the age of COVID, that's all changed. You know, that's been very difficult because literally every agency that I'm involved in has had some response. The Missouri State team has responded everywhere throughout the state of Missouri, doing testing and alternate care sites and everything. Same thing with RSI in Louisiana. RSI has set up several low acuity alternate care sites and helped with testing in Louisiana. For this, and then the fire department's had a significant impact from COVID also. So until COVID, it wasn't that difficult. Now, with COVID, it's extremely difficult to kind of balance all of them and try to figure out where I can be and when I can be.
Well, it's a good thing you have an option. Yeah, COVID's different in terms of it's everywhere, everywhere. One final question. We've been talking about the civil unrest and what protocols there may or may not be for EMS folks to stay safe. Were you involved in Ferguson at all?
From a planning aspect, my boots weren't on the ground there, but I was supporting with IAP development and planning. But going beyond, you know, the problem with Ferguson and actually with some of the, you know, the disruptions we've had recently around the country, the problem that I see is, one, there's different protocols in different areas. Like EMS, some places EMS won't tie to fire. I'm sorry, EMS won't tie to law enforcement. They'll be called in when they feel the scene safe. Some places EMS will go into the warm zone. So the training is not universal. And the policies aren't universal everywhere you go. So when you're going into one environment, EMS is standing back and waiting till everything's secure. We're in another environment, they're in ballistic gear, a little bit behind the cops in like a warm zone, ready to provide care. So I think the complexity with this is, one, we don't have all the same training, and two, we don't have the same gear, and three, we're just not using the same policies, which is not going to make things flow well, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense, and that's something we really need to work on because these kinds of things are not going to go away. And Joe, that's kind of what you guys do at Paragon, and I'm sure Jamie will be talking about that. Any final thoughts, Joe?
Well, you know, we've been all over the place tonight. And that's in a good way. I think that just shows that, you know, there's so many different aspects to being able to respond to disaster, and that part of what makes disaster response and disaster medicine so fascinating and such a love of mine is that it is an opportunity to innovate and think outside the box and apply technologies, concepts, actions that, you know, in many cases before, we never thought much about how to do that. And, you know, look at us now, we're talking about using, you know, drones that are on tracked vehicles to drive into collapsed structures and, you know, fly overhead and do infrared stuff and, you know, putting GPS trackers on our dogs and all kinds of things that 5 years ago we were clueless about. So, progress is being made. We just got to keep innovating and keep looking for new, interesting technologies that we can adopt.
Yes, and it sounds like a lot more training for the local agencies and making sure they work together, and even resources that may come in from the outside, like Tim made a very good point. If we're all trained differently, that's not going to work too well. Jamie, I'm going to throw it back to you.
And that's a perfect segue, Sam, because I think training is paramount. As Tim pointed out, the need for some sort of standardized expectation of training level and training capabilities is important. And at the same time, as Joe pointed out, you need to be able to be flexible and innovative. And I think that, Paragon Medical Education Group provides a perfect juxtaposition of those two points where they come together of, amazing experience in training and coupled with innovative techniques to make training just that much better. And, Joe, you guys do such a fantastic job. As things are opening up, I know you're getting busier again, which is great. Where can folks reach out to you to get on the schedule or even just talk to somebody about the innovative, customized ways you can come into their system?
Well, we would certainly love to talk to folks about how we can customize something for them. And they can reach us at paragonmedicalgroup.com on the web, Paragon Medical Group on Facebook, or our Disaster Podcast website or Facebook page.
And we appreciate all the help and assistance you give to make sure we can get this show out there every week. And we, I know that people listening appreciate it as well. Tim, is there a place where folks can reach out to you if they have questions about anything we've talked about tonight, or maybe how to implement some of the things you've done in your area in their system?
Yeah, they can go to the Response Systems Inc. website, which is the just Google Response System Inc. It'll take you right there. Or if they can get in contact with Sam, Sam can give my contact information. I'm more than happy to talk to them.
Fantastic. And Tim, thanks for coming on the show. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, since we mentioned IDMC, which is the Disaster Medical, we used to call it, we wanted to call it a cooperative, but Brian said we needed a goat. So it's collaborative. There you go. Interstate Disaster. I never will forget that. So we have a website under IDMC, and where you usually find me on social media, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. Certainly in our Facebook page, which I will coerce Tim to join, and on the disasterpodcast.com website. Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations, so please friend or follow me over there. And, of course, on their Disaster Podcast Group, which is still continuing to grow and get stronger. As Sam said, she's going to try to get Tim in there. We have a lot of our former guests from episodes in there and a huge base of expertise in a variety of things. And when you think back to all of the different topics we've covered on this show in the last 8 years, it's pretty amazing to think about what we've been able to do and the amount of accumulated experience that exists in the group. If you've got a problem, we've probably got somebody in there who's got some level of expertise to help you get through it. So we hope you'll take advantage of that and join that group over there. Sam, great episode tonight, and I hope that folks will, keep an eye out for what we have coming up around the bend.
That's it, and it's nice to hear from someone from the Midwest because we don't have a lot of people out there, so we'll keep Tim on tap, hopefully not because there's a disaster, but, just to keep up on what's going on. So basically, he talked about a lot of the planning, a lot of the different team interactions, so I guess we can call this one Disaster operations. So disaster operations are not everyday operations.